Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life.
All right, welcome to the Idle Red Hands. I'm Jeremy.
I'm Wayne.
And why is Wayne here today?
Because you broke him with Burger King.
Yes. I bribed him with Burger King and asked him to talk a little bit about something that he's been working on lately that I thought was definitely worth talking about and something that people would like to know. So basically, what you're doing is creating a Death Watch setting. So the Warhammer Games Workshop, Warhammer 40K Death Watch, and adapting it not to the system that they've already done, I think Fantasy Flight.
D100
system. And so you took a look at that and said, maybe not for me.
That's to put it mildly. Yeah.
So what do you do when there's an IP that you love and a world that you want to play in, but you don't like the system? And I think you're solving that problem to solve that problem.
The easy answer is you port it to a system that you actually like.
Right,
or
right.
I think would be better. In that case, the system I used for the Death Watch game I'm kind of putting together was Cortex Prime, which actually hasn't been released yet.
Oh, okay.
I believe you can go and order it on BackerKit. Because I'm involved in actually something that's going to come out with it, I have access to the SRD, the system reference document, and have also been given previews of the book. But I should say Cortex Prime is one of the, I guess, the latest evolution of the Cortex system, which the previous incarnation was Cortex Plus, which Lyle, Chris, and I did a review of Marvel Heroic Roleplaying, which is the heroic version of Cortex Plus. Leverage, which we played a one-off game that was intended to be a campaign but didn't go anywhere, is action version of Cortex Plus. And Smallville, which we never played but own a bunch of copies of, is the dramatic version of Cortex Plus.
I see.
Cortex Prime kind of takes parts from all three of those in a toolbox approach. So Cortex Prime has kind of sort of, here's your basic framework. Here's all these other options and switches and dials and stuff that you can turn on or off to essentially replicate Cortex Plus heroic action or dramatic or kind of any version in between.
Right.
And it was because of that modularity that I said, okay, well, let me do a game of Death Watch. And that actually started from looking at the Cortex Prime through traits and stuff and saying, what would a Space Marine look like in this system? And the reason it all works together is, brief overview, everything in Cortex Plus on your character is rated in a die. Goes from a D4 to a D12. You don't use D20s, which is part of why I like it, because screw that damn D20 die. I hate that thing. And generally speaking, player characters have three kind of primary traits they pull dice from. Generally, that is distinctions, which are kind of like aspects in Fate. There's something descriptive about your character that is a kind of a double-edged sword, because you can either use it positively or negatively and get rewarded for doing so. The other sort of main dice trait is usually an attribute. And Cortex Prime defaults to physical, mental, social. I should mention, just reminded, the Firefly game was also a later version of Cortex Plus.
Okay.
And then it's distinctions, attribute, and skill. So when you whenever you do something in Cortex Prime, you grab a handful of dice that match up to whatever traits are appropriate for the thing your character is doing. So, for example, if you had a distinction of fastest gun in the West, if you were in a shootout, you would pick that. Then you would probably use physical, because if you're shooting, and then maybe you'd like your skill in gunslinging or whatever. And you would take those three dice, roll them, pick two, and total them as your, I guess, action number. And then a third die becomes your effect die. The size of the effect die matters, not the number on it.
Oh, right, right.
So I like the system because there's a I think there's a nice tension between, okay, I have a big die, I have a D12. Am I going to use that for the number it rolls to increase my total, which makes me or gives me a better chance of success? Or am I going to save that for the effect die? Because the bigger the effect die, the kind of more stress I'm going to deal, or the faster I'm going to do something.
Right.
So I like the choices that are there. But then with Death Watch, obviously, Space Marines are, I'll be honest, kind of boring. they're all clones. They're literally clones of each other. So they're all pretty much the same thing. And the real difference comes in kind of what chapter they're part of a little bit. And also what equipment, mainly what equipment they're looking down with. And I thought for a while about how, or what traits you'd use for a character. First, I thought about roles. Mm-hmm. Roles are used in the leverage game, where you had grifter, mastermind, hacker, thief, and hitter. Mm-hmm. And based on kind of what you were doing, those were kind of five broad areas of influence. But Space Marines don't really do that. They pretty much do one thing, which is kill right. enemies of the Emperor. So roles didn't really work. And then I thought about tying roles to equipment type. Like, okay, you have a Devastator, you have a Assault Marine, you have a Tactical Marine, you have Apothecary and all that stuff. But then I'm like, but that really depends on equipment.
Right.
When would a Tactical Marine without Heavy Bolter ever use the Devastator role? You wouldn't. Yes. And it doesn't make sense. It's not a video game. It doesn't make sense to, like, swap out. Mm-hmm. You're not going to pull a Heavy Bolter out of your non-existent Ceramite pocket. Right. So eventually, I went with distinction, attribute, and equipment. Equipment, I kind of built them like powers from the Marvel heroic role-playing game.
Hmm.
In that they are just kind of contribute a die, and just basically whenever you're using that piece of equipment, you'll get to include that die in your role. That's kind of where that came from. Then hit upon Death Watch, because kind of like Legend of the Five Rings, it's an interesting idea where you have all these different Marines from different chapters working together under a common goal. And there's a little bit of tension in that the chapters are going to do things slightly differently. Mm-hmm. Not radically differently, because then you stray to heresy and that gene seed gets wiped out. But so I thought that was interesting. And also, it's kind of the classic, okay, you're all working together for a common goal. So that was where that came from. I used, as you mentioned, the FFG and then Ulysses Spiel, actual Death Watch RPG as inspiration for a lot of the, I guess, special powers and kind of talents and things that the characters had. Also used the Kill Team and Warhammer 40,000 8th edition rulebook to kind of get a baseline of how powerful weapons and stuff would be. For example, I just made a bolter like a D8. And then kind of using that as a baseline with kind of like strength 4, I said, okay, well, thing last gun of strength 3, that becomes scales down to a D6. Heavy bolter, it kind of scales up to a D10. Mm-hmm. You don't go higher than 12, D12 in Cortex, which meant if you had a 4, then like 5-6, but you're looking at like strength 7 or strength 8, like plasma weapons. Like you can double dice, or if something would step up, which means increase to a larger die size, and you can't go past a D12, but then you would add like another D6 to the pool. So there are ways to do it. And again, it wasn't a direct translation.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of more taking the spirit, machine spirit, of this kind of thing, and okay, what would it look like given this new system for something as radically different as going from a percentile game to Cortex Plus, really can't do a one-to-one translation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's kind of silly to try.
Yeah. I think it's a good choice, too, because it's Kill Team. So it's like, you know, five-member kill teams, and you're not going to have vehicle rules and things. Yeah. So
I specifically did not give the Assault Marine a jump pack, because I didn't want to deal with that.
Right.
Like, how fast are you moving? I don't really know. I did introduce, or I did kind of have to make range rules.
Yes.
Because 40K kind of is more tactical than a regular game or other games of Cortex Plus, and how far a weapon can shoot is really going to matter.
Mm-hmm.
So I did have to build in range rules. Basically, I just kind of made five different weapon types, like melee grenade, pistol, rifle, assault, maybe in heavy, and just said, okay, they can all shoot, or certain ones can shoot 2, 3, 4 range bands. But rather than just having it stop, I built in penalties for it. That's the effective range.
Right.
If you want to shoot at something farther away, dice are going to step down, so they become less effective. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't make it impossible to hit. Mm-hmm. It just makes it less likely you're going to do damage, or you're going to have to spend more resources to do that. But then that also kind of factored into movement, where I just said, okay, movement, you're going to be able to move like one range band per turn for free. Make a roll if you want to move farther. Because, again, weapons are what differentiate the Space Marines and Kill Team from each other, and that's going to be a big deal. You kind of don't want them all to function the same, because then everybody's going to feel the same.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Once you were talking about that, that made me think about, wow, how about minis? There should be minis for this Kill Team. And
it's not like it's based on a miniature war game franchise.
Right, right. When you talk about ranges and just representing different characters, I thought, yeah, that would be really fun to put together and paint. So that's why we're together tonight. And before we actually do that, we just wanted to have a quick conversation about the thoughts that you had behind this and kind of your motivation. So we have the starter set for Death Watch, full of all kinds of options for equipping your veterans. originally, because you've already run this, right? You had a test, a session of this.
It wasn't as long as I'd hoped for, but yeah, I've run it.
What went well? What didn't go as well as you thought? Like, or are there things you had to tweak? Because we're going to be doing another session of this in about a week, right?
Yeah.
So what did you run into as far as like things that didn't work as you expected?
The biggest thing I ran into was a trait that I made called team.
Mm-hmm.
Because the characters are a kill team, and the idea is you are working together. And to emphasize that, I borrowed an idea from the Cortex Plus Hacker's Guide. They reskinned Marvel Heroic to kind of fantasy heroic, kind of D&D. And one of the optional rules was an extra trait called team. And it was just a die that started as a D6, and you included it in your dice pool, and it just kind of represented everybody acting together and kind of following the same mission. And it stepped up when you made a kind of a benefit for one of your team members, or you helped a team member step back a negative complication. So I liked how that worked, because it mechanically rewarded the players for acting as a team.
Yeah.
Kind of reinforced the fact that you are a kill team. You should be helping each other.
Right.
The problem I ran into was I only had two players in that one kind of test game. And right out of the gate, the first action one player did was to make an asset, which is kind of a technical term, but basically he made a beneficial die for future use in the scene, mm-hmm. and also spent the resources to make it available to his battle brother.
Mm-hmm.
So that stepped team up to a D8. Second player made another asset and also spent the resources to make it available to his fellow battle brother. So that's like the second action of the game. Team is now a D10. The highest the die can go is 12.
Right.
And
right.
a D10 is a pretty significant bonus. And everybody includes it as long as you are not by your... Every character includes it as long as you are not by yourself. The only way to step it back mm-hmm. was to voluntarily step it back for kind of like a fate point. In Cortex mm-hmm. Prime, they're called a plot point, which mm-hmm. allow you to do other things.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody did that. So it stayed at a D10 for the remainder of that scene, which is unfortunately all we got through,
which
was a big bonus. So I'm wondering if it needs to step back when someone suffers stress,
mm-hmm.
so that I'm active, as the GM, I'm actively knocking it down to kind of force the players to choose between doing something else or helping a team member, or if it was just kind of like a fluke, like if it's going to be fine as it is. Only that one test game kind of wasn't enough of a test to find out. But that was one of the biggest things I took away from that game going, did I kind of overpower that, or did I make a mistake with that?
Yeah, because, if you had... five other players, they could get it up to a D12 every time.
As long as there are other ways to earn plot points.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of wonder if providing these other ways disincentivizes stepping that die back to earn a plot point.
Right.
I'm going to leave things as they are for the game we run, but mm-hmm. it will be something I'm kind of will be paying attention to.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, me too now.
Yeah.
Now I'm aware of it. Wow, well, that's great. Also, when you were looking at what Fantasy Flight had put together, what were the biggest turnoffs, and why was Cortex Prime more appealing to you, just as far as like your tastes in RPGs?
Recently, I've tended to kind of skew more towards narrative games,
mm-hmm.
and the Fantasy Flight, now Ulysses S. Spiel, actual Death Watch RPG, I'm sure will appeal to a lot of people, especially people who like Pathfinder level of complexity. That's what it struck me as, in Pathfinder, very much not to my tastes. Percentile die games are fine, just looking at looking at an NPC stat block for like a typical Gene Stealer, which is the archetypical Death Watch opponent.
Right.
You have your stat block of like 5 or 6 attributes. Then you had a list of like 15 traits, 10 more talents,
mm-hmm.
and then like 3 or 4 Gene Stealer only special rules. And the traits and talents were literally just powerful blow, which means I have to go back in the book to go find out what that does, or all these things leap up. And I'm like, for me, this is a turnoff, because if I were to run this game, I either have to make a prodigious amount of notes to keep track of all the special rules that all these things have,
mm-hmm.
or I have to keep flicking back and forth in the book, or I have to take the time to memorize it all.
Yeah.
And kind of much like Pathfinder, it just seemed like there was a lot of super fiddly stuff that would happen during the game that I frankly don't want to deal with when mm-hmm. I'm running a game, because there's a lot of other stuff you're trying to manage and pay attention to,
right.
and having to remember what all of these traits and talents did wasn't all that much fun, or didn't seem all that much fun to me.
Right.
And it was the same thing with the characters. Mm-hmm. Like, they all seemed pretty awesome when it kind of did their stuff. Like, two A4 sheets right. you have to do to print all this stuff out. Right. And that is a condensed version of right. the rules. Like, if you printed out actually all the game text so someone could run it, it'd be like 3, 4, 5, which was a big turnoff. Like some other games, Cortex Prime, you just kind of have a little description for what the die is, mm-hmm. and you also kind of leave it open to interpretation about when it gets used or not. That was actually one of the challenges, because I wanted, when I run like a one-shot or a convention game, I don't feel it's fair to have or to force the players to know anything at all about the setting or the system.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fun, but it was also kind of a challenge to write the chapter distinctions in such a way that someone who knew nothing about 40K would go, okay, I kind of understand what this chapter is about and how I would use this die either positively or negatively.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also not an info dump.
Yes.
Yeah. I tried to keep them to like 3 sentences maximum. Mm-hmm. So that was fun, but also kind of a challenge, almost kind of like graphic design. Like, okay, how much information can you cram into these 3 sentences without overloading people and also still keeping it useful?
Yeah, nice. Yeah.
But kind of the narrative flexibility is why I went with Cortex Prime.
Mm-hmm.
I was also kind of doing other stuff with it. I also like how the GM handles opposition in Cortex Prime.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, whenever a player rolls dice and it comes up as a 1, the GM buys that die from the player.
Oh.
You can't use the 1 in your total. Set them aside. I'll give you a plot point for every 1 you rolled.
Mm-hmm.
And in certain iterations of the game, I will then add that die to something called the Doom Pool.
Nice. Yeah.
Whenever we need to know the difficulty number of something, sort of like whenever a character is taking action against kind of the ambient game rather than a specific character, the Doom Pool is my opposition. I just pick up all those dice, roll mm-hmm. them, total 2... and then have an effect die.
Ah,
so
nice.
It's the same thing.
Yeah,
so nice. I can also, it's also a pacing mechanic, because I can spend a dice from the Doom Pool to do certain things. Like, I can spend this D8 to give you the complication jammed bolter D8.
Mm-hmm.
And the die is now gone.
Mm-hmm.
So it does take a little bit of practice to pace out this Doom Pool mechanic, because if you just keep all the dice in it, the difficulty is going to get real hard and the players won't be able to do anything.
Right, right. Yeah.
But if you spend them all, then it's going to be real low.
Yes.
But just my own GMing style is I almost kind of don't want to have to decide what the difficulty number of something is.
Mm-hmm.
And with the Doom Pool, I don't have to. I can just say, great, here's the thing you're trying. Let's see how difficult that is.
Yeah, roll them all. That's nice.
Yeah. I just prefer that to then having to arbitrarily decide how difficult it is for you to shoot a gene stealer that's like, I don't know, 50 meters away or something like that.
Right. Some different systems, like the 2D20 system, has points that kind of go back and forth between the GM and the players. And so I think that's really nice, because that's something that they can see. So they're like, oh, okay, whoa, this might be really hard, but let's, yeah.
Yeah, and all roles in, they say it right in the beginning, all roles in Cortex Prime are out in the open.
Yeah,
that's nice.
There's so nothing
notes,
behind the screen.
Nothing behind the screen. I mean, notes and stuff, sure. But it's like, yeah, you see the Doom Pool, and much like Fate, there are kind of aspects or complications or assets that can be created sort of and attached to a scene, to a character, to stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to use sticky notes and put the die value right there. So mm-hmm. it's like, here's this die, because it's singular. And it's important for me that it's a physical die, because when that thing comes into play, we're actually going to pick it up and mm-hmm. roll it as mm-hmm. part of the pool, and then it'll kind of go back. So you're right. Being able to see the size of the Doom Pool, the size of all the other dice on there, it does make it difficult, for me at least, to run a virtual game like that, because
I
like having those physical dice to manipulate. And it also does kind of require a big table, which is sort of at a premium in Japan sometimes.
Yeah, right.
But
that's true.
I do like kind of the physical and kind of tactile nature of actually manipulating the dice of like, okay, well, I'm going to combine these two dice into a stepped up version and kind of doing that. You also need a lot of dice. Back to the question about what I would do differently.
Mm-hmm.
If I had the ability to, I would color code the different die sizes. Because
I bought
a bunch of D&D set dice where it's kind of one of all the 6 things in a bunch of different colors. And so I just dumped all these dice on the table for my 2 players who knew very little about the setting or the system.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't slow the game down, but even for me, looking at this pool of multicolored polyhedrals, it was kind of like, okay, well, that one's a D4, that one's a D6, that one's there's my pool.
Mm-hmm.
And if I just had one color for 4s, one color for 6, mm-hmm. one color for 8, that made things vastly easier.
So for the Cortex Prime, for their Kickstarter, did they do custom die or dice or anything?
The campaign was for sort of the main rule book, then kind of like, I forget what the spotlights, and spotlight was one of the things that I wrote, where they got a bunch of authors to write different spotlights. So it's going to be, here's a unique setting, and here are how you use bits and pieces of the Cortex Prime rule set to emulate or to do this thing.
Right.
So
nice. And what were some examples of some of the settings that people did for spotlights?
Well, the one that I wrote was, surprise, paranormal romance.
Right.
It was essentially, if you're familiar with the Secret Circle book series, it was that. It's teenage witches. And some of the other ones were kind of like cyberpunk stuff or kind of like space opera pulp. I think there's a couple kind of sword and sorcery ones.
Hmm.
Similar to what's in the Cortex Plus Hacker's Guide. They did a really good job, I think, with that book, where they divided up into, okay, here's kind of a rundown of each of those three systems. Here's modern day. Here's future. Here's kind of fantasy.
Hmm.
And what you could do with those different things and kind of optional rules and stuff. They're close enough where they're almost kind of actually backwards compatible.
Oh, really?
I mean, to the point where, like, all they did was combine and clean up the Cortex Plus under one umbrella of Prime.
Mm. And these are the same writers and creators and the same publisher that
Not a different publisher, because Margaret Weiss Productions did Cortex Plus.
Okay.
And I think, I'm not exactly sure, but I think Margaret Weiss Productions kind of stopped with the role-playing games and went back mostly to books. Cam Banks, the lead designer of, I think, Marvel Heroic, and also work on like the Leverage game, he then licensed the Cortex system name from Margaret Weiss, who I guess still owns it. So, and he's the one who did the Kickstarter and is writing Prime. So it's the same team that put together, just kind of under a different company name.
Mm.
But it's essentially the same thing. Yeah.
Good. Fun. So if anybody's interested in looking at that, do they have a late pledge on their Kickstarter?
Yes, I believe the backer kit thing link is open.
Okay. It is frustrating. Your favorite IPs and a good rule system are kind of hard to come by. And what's funny is now we're in a time with role-playing where there are such a diversity of systems, and people settle on, you know, Savage Worlds or, you know, Powered by the Apocalypse or something that they like, and they want to adapt things to that. So I think it's a little bit challenging, because it used to be, oh, this is the Star Wars role-playing game. It's a D6 game, and that's all there is. That's what you're going to play. And people didn't, you know.
I kind of think people have always been hacking stuff.
Yeah. They're definitely homebrew. So what are your feelings about that? Because I know you've had, I mean, I've seen a few projects that you've worked on, and, you know, you like characters and IPs. There's certain IPs that you like, and you want to play those in a game. You want to play in that game world. And so you're always tempted to take characters and like, okay, let's stat these characters out for this system. So is that a little frustrating for you? Because it's like not something then it has to be free. It has to be homebrew. It has to be for personal use only because these are licensed characters. But is that something you keep getting compelled kind of into those worlds?
Yeah, I think it is what it is, positive, negative. Usually whatever media I am currently consuming, I say, man, that would make a great role-playing game.
Mm-hmm.
Like, slight tangent, I just started watching the DreamWorks Trollhunters CGI thing, which is really good. And of course, I thought, hey, that would make a great RPG. But then, as you said, I was a little bit thinking about it and developing this more, especially with the GW IP.
Right.
And because everyone knows, they are litigious. Like, even just looking at the back of this box with all the colors, every single color name is trademark.
Right.
So, and like, the names on everything is trademark. And they tried to trademark Space Marine. So I was, after this went farther than just kind of a slight throwaway idea, because I have so many of those, it really struck me that, I will not be able to do anything professional with this. This will only ever be for public, or for maybe possibly even for private home use, because who knows? I've seen websites for other companies get taken down when people were producing free stuff just because the company said, you know, you don't have permission to use this. And I don't think this would get big enough for that to happen, but that is in the back of my mind. I guess in the sense, it is kind of frustrating knowing that if you do work, you should be fairly compensated for it. And this is a pet project, so I'm totally fine not making anything for it. But I am aware that this is all it could ever be.
Right.
Maybe distribute some stuff to people who are interested. And also, the full disclosure, I'm using the Ulysses Spiel free RPG Day Deathwatch Adventure as the basis for this adventure thing that I'm writing up. Mm-hmm. So I've thought about putting together a package with the, you know, just like a PDF package with the 6 pre-generated characters, and here's kind of the basic scenario. I am not enough of a legal expert to know whether the fact that this product was released for free kind of allows me borrow a bit more heavily from it, or just kind of say, yes, this in fact is the one just for a different system, or if I would have to kind of file the serial numbers off. Box text verbatim would just be like, here's a very brief setup, scene one, scene two, scene three.
So what about an approach where you're specifically looking at a system or a book and you're saying, okay, I love all this material. I love the adventures and everything you did. And here's my, like, conversion key. Like, you know, this is how to play this in a different system. So, you know, definitely buy their book, but try, you know, but play it in this system. I think there's something that might be there. I mean, and that's kind of what people do when they homebrew or convert stuff. Yeah. And that might be something that has some life or actually could, attract people.
I think you could do that from one RPG to another.
Mm-hmm.
You could provide some kind of conversion key. But then you kind of run into the problem of, okay, now you've got two companies involved.
Right. Because
if you're going to like translate from D&D to Pathfinder, I mean, they're the same thing, surprise! in case you didn't hear that coming from me. But if you went like, I don't know, like D&D to Savage Worlds or something,
mm-hmm.
now you have Wizard of the Coast and Pinnacle Entertainment, that would have to be kind of involved.
Unless
it was getting back to that unofficial
fan
conversion, like we're not looking to challenge the trademark or whatever. But if you went from another form of media, book, TV show, whatever, to an RPG, I don't think you could make a key. Because, I mean, think about how many systems there are and how many people love a specific kind of character that's not even from that system, and all the different versions of whatever that you get. You would run into that, not problem, but that issue about, well, no, I would want to do this person, this and stuff. Who cares how many ranks in cooking this person has, you know? It doesn't matter.
It's so funny because people do kind of sort, they dig through the media they're consuming. And so they've even, when they're creating a character for a campaign, it's just, oh, I'm Legolas, you know, I'm Indiana Jones. You know, basically you're like, you're pulling things out of pop culture. So it's so funny that because IPs are so heavily protected and managed that it does make it harder. But that's what role-playing has always been. I mean, people have always been like, we're playing Lord of the Rings, guys, you know, but we can't say Hobbit. We're saying Halfling.
Oh, yeah. We can say Hobbit up until a certain point.
Right.
It's like we can say Cthulhu Mythos up until a certain point. And then it's like, nope, never mind.
Yeah, so it's a funny thing. And I think maybe RPGs are always going to be wrestling with the IP problem because, there's official licensed RPGs and sometimes they're just not that good or they're not what you want, you know, for that world.
No, it's a good point. But I think we might be at the point now where enough companies know what RPGs are, especially we were talking earlier about with, like, the massive popularity of Critical Role. And getting, like, billboards and stuff.
And
filling auditoriums with fans and viewers. In the past, I think it was a bit, probably more difficult to find a dedicated game to that IP that you liked, where now we might be getting to the point where companies know enough about what RPGs are, at least peripherally, to be interested in making one. Which, getting back a little bit to Margaret Weiss Productions, that seems to be pretty much all they did. Leverage, Firefly, Marvel, Serenity before that, they almost kind of seem to specialize in licensed RPGs, which might have gotten expensive, which is, unfortunately, I think that's what happened to Marvel.
Right.
Because books for Marvel Heroic were made, but then kind of like never got released, and I guess because they lost the license, or maybe it was just too expensive to keep. But the slight problem with that is, I don't think the people in charge of the companies have to know what a role-playing game is.
Mm-hmm.
And let's be fair, they're a company, so their bottom line would be making money.
Right.
So, and it's all the taste. So picking up a dedicated IP role-playing game, flipping through it and going, this isn't as great as I expected it to be, might happen fairly often.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you're completely open to interpretation. So what one person might think is a steaming pile of crap, they're like, oh, this is fantastic, you know?
That's true. It's just getting more and more complicated because there's more and more systems. So people have, you know, there's more niche and diverse tastes now in role-playing. It's not just Dungeons & Dragons style. Yeah. It's not just, you know.
Contrary to popular belief, Dungeons & Dragons is not the only role-playing game.
Yeah, right. But it's got that Xerox Kleenex thing going. People know exactly what you're talking about.
Which, on the one hand, is a benefit, But, I don't know, as you said, there's more systems coming out, which, from my perspective, is actually a good thing because that means you have so many more tools
Yes.
with which to run that IP that you love so much. Again, you mentioned kind of Apocalypse World. There was a game that came out that I Kickstarted called The Watch, which I'd be interested in playing sometime. Which, if you don't know what The Watch is, and spoiler, it's a fantasy game about thinly veiled toxic masculinity.
Oh, yeah.
Where, like, it's a war. It's kind of, imagine the Rangers from Lord of the Rings, where, like, a shadow has come across the land and all these individual clans have banded together to form something called The Watch to repel it. But, this is stated right from the beginning, men and masculine-identifying people are way more susceptible to the shadow, so The Watch is entirely female and non-binary people. And you can expect, the pushback that happened was monumental. But, I mean, they blatantly say, this is about toxic masculinity, and that's kind of the theme of the game. But the reason I brought it up is, even prior to coming up with this, I looked at The Watch and something clicked in my brain, and I said, Adeptus Sororitas and Chaos.
Yeah.
You could totally do that, which is something I eventually want to do.
That's true.
Because Powered by the Apocalypse, everything is very narrative, so there would be practically no mechanical system to conversion to do that. Just instead of saying Fantasy World, it's great, you're all female space marines in powered armor, and that's pretty much all you would need to do to run that. But
very funny. That reminds me of, like, the comic Why the Last Man. The disease that wiped out all men. So, yeah, just that angle, I think, is a very funny, and especially for kind of the newer crowd of role players, I think that's a very, very interesting setting. It'd be interesting to have a whole group of guys, a whole bunch of chin beards trying to get through that system.
Well, that's because I don't think chin beards actually play that. I mean, like, what? I can't be a play guy? And my thing is, why'd you want to? Much as I'm looking forward to running this game, and as much as the fun as I've had, like, putting it together, I have been struck multiple times by the fact that this is very much, like, not my usual style of game. Big hulking muscle dudes in, like, powered armor. Nobody kisses. It doesn't matter. I'm just like, you just kill everything instead of talking to it. Wow, what the... Really? I'm running this game?
Yeah, the only social interaction is the chapter disses, you know?
Yeah. That's pretty much it. Yeah. Because really, who are you going to interact with? I'm going to go convince that person to talk.
Yeah, but I'm really interested in the system and seeing how it works, because I never played the Marvel version of it. Yeah, as far as, like, how action works and the plot points and things.
If you go back and listen to the review we did of Marvel Heroic, I'm not a superhero comic book, or even kind of like a comic book person at all. So when it first got announced, I was kind of like, okay, whatever. I'll look into it. Got the book and was like, what am I looking at?
Yeah.
Because I was expecting a Pathfinder / D&D style game with what type of hero are you, what level of power do you have, and all the stuff. And it was very much not that. And it took us a while to kind of wrap our heads around how things work, just because it was so different from what we were expecting. But, like, it's become one of my favorite systems, just because it is so open and kind of more narrative. And that those... Actually, manipulating the dice is enough of a mechanic, but what each die represents is interpreted enough where it kind of scratches both those itches.
That's nice.
And even the different flavors of Cortex Prime, they all function the same way, but everyone has distinctions. That's common across all the things. But rolling attribute and skill feels very different from rolling a motivation and a relationship versus rolling, like, a specialty and a piece of equipment. The game all functions the same way. You roll a dice, you total two of them, and you keep one. But calling those dice buckets different things really makes the game feel different, which is why I like it so much. Just by changing the name of this thing, you almost completely change the tone and feel of the game.
That's really cool, yeah. And it's nice, yeah, that a system can accommodate that, because basically in traditional role-playing, when you're doing social things, most of the times nobody's rolling anything. It's just pure roleplay.
I mean, you go back to OSR. We didn't have skills or social things. Like, what? Which is kind of a bit alien to me now. Because it's kind of what we would call, I think it's getting off track, kind of what we would call metagaming, where you were encouraged to use your player knowledge to figure out those devious traps of, okay, I'm going to drop the marbles on the floor, and which way do they roll? And okay, it sloped that way, and blow the chalk dust, and you know, whatever. And there weren't skills on your character sheet for doing that. You just kind of had to think of that. And my God, looking at the original Tomb of Horrors or whatever adventure, and just like the amount of bull crap that was in that. It's like, if you put the gem in the statue's hands 5 times, it'll crush it to dust. But on the 6th time, it makes an invisible, super powerful gem that the guys are going to want. And you're just like, really? I shouldn't complain about that one, since it was specifically designed as a tournament module to mess with the assumptions that high-level players had.
Right.
It's like, okay, this is how we beat it. And you're like, nope, psych.
Yeah, yeah. Because the game, it existed long enough that, it got self-conscious. It became self-aware.
Which is funny, because I saw people kind of complaining when the Hasbro CEO said something along the lines of looking for ways to turn D&D into a kind of like almost like an e-sport or a tournament thing, and the number of people that kind of were like, no, oh my god. But then, like, and I was honestly kind of a little bit like that too. I'm like, how do you play a competitive role-playing game? And someone said original Tomb of Horrors, old style, like that. And you're like, oh right, that's almost kind of where the hobby came from. You were expected to kind of beat the game by doing this, and I'm kind of curious to see what, if anything, comes of that. It would be a very different style of play than I would prefer, because then the focus would be a lot more on completing whatever that thing is about rather than kind of enjoying the organic story that pops up. But, I mean, there's no wrong way to have fun, except there is sometimes, you know.
And how many more things that aren't sports do they need to put on those ESPN channels that nobody watches, like chess and, you know?
I was just thinking, like, oh, geez, instead of eSports, it would be D&D sports, right. Wouldn't it? Oh, geez.
It's a funny idea that I don't know if, but you know, everybody, whatever is popular, whatever, because video games, everyone is trying to develop the next big esport platform. So, how does role playing fit into that? It doesn't. It's a social activity. It's not something where you, I don't know. That's exactly what companies do.
Yeah, exactly.
They try to.
You know, someone might actually do it and be like, oh, yeah.
Yeah,
oh,
that's how it really works. Yeah.
Dedicated D&D channel. Oh, my God. I'm laughing, but I'm also kind of dying a little bit inside.
Yeah.
Like, stereotype, but imagine the people that would be on screen for a D&D game.
Yeah. It would be rough. But I noticed, though, like, if you look at older footage and, you know, video of people role-playing back in the day, they're much better looking now. People are...
Now.
It's like, because you know, we've got this internet, you know, kind of millennials are more image conscious, much more, you know, they know their camera angles.
Not us, obviously. You're right. Actually, I'm a year off from being a millennial, so I guess that doesn't apply to me.
Oh, okay. So I think that's very funny that... and maybe that explains also some of the popularity, because it isn't these people, you're like, why would you ever want to be in a room with those people? Right. It's actually likable, attractive, and a mix of gender, a mix of a diverse group of people playing it, which changes people's reactions.
Right. The flip side of that is people complain about only doing it because they're attractive. I've seen a couple, I thought, completely wrong, like, messages or tweets and stuff about, like, oh, the cool kids are kicking us out of our hobby, whatever. And it's kind of like, well, okay, doing stereotypes here, but like, how about you clean yourself up, put on some deodorant, you know?
Right.
But like, I say that, but it's a joke. But like, more importantly, just because other people enjoy something doesn't mean you have to stop enjoying that thing.
Right.
So it's not like there's limited space in the role-playing game hobby. I mean,
the complaints about forced diversity or things that, I mean, the previous versions of those things that you love so much still exist. They're still in print. And especially now that we have digital, that stuff is archived forever. So you can always stop at a certain point, just like people with their musical tastes or whatever. It's like, I don't listen to this new stuff that the kids, it needs to evolve. Like, you know, role-playing evolves like anything else. So if it's not for you anymore, it's still all that stuff that you played, you know, when you were a university student still is there.
Nobody has come into your house and burned those books that you liked playing.
Your elves must be gender fluid.
Yeah. Well, plus, it's also like, I mean, what was the big thing during that time that minority groups got told? It's like, well, you're playing a game of imagination. Imagine whatever you want to be. And that now applies to everyone who's complaining about the forced diversity thing. It's like, oh, I don't want to play this game. It's like, sorry, mofo, imagine yourself as the cis straight white guy. Like, that's what you told us.
Right.
So that's what you get told. How do you like it?
Right. You know? that's a good
point. Or the other one is like, oh, go make your own game. It's like, we did. No, not like that, you know? It's like, sorry. You don't like that? Go make your own game again. No way to segue to...
But
well, speaking of diversity, not a lot in the Kill Team box.
It's almost zero.
Yeah. To be fair, they are clones, but still.
Yeah, they've been genetically made that way, yes. Emotionless killing machines.
Yep.
that's a nice thing to, you know, to play in different worlds and different settings and get different, because, you know, like you're saying, this is not what you would usually want to play, a setting you'd usually want to play, but it's interesting. It's fun. It's got that, there's a kind of old school human against non-human charm to it, you know, the kill the bugs kind of thing.
Again, speaking of that pre-RPG game day adventure, I think it's called Final Sanction. Like, reading through it, yeah, okay, it's a lot of fighting aliens and stuff, because that's what the Death Watch does.
Right.
But I was also surprised at how much social interaction they put in, and not between the Battle Brothers. I'm like, oh, right, okay, you still kind of have to deal with people, and sure, it could be a bolt around to the head.
Yeah, right.
But there are other ways of getting past kind of the roadblock that get thrown up in front of you. And,
nice.
And they actually also worked in reasons to not just kill everybody.
That's good.
And it didn't seem like, kind of like ham-fisted or forced in, but...
Wow.
Again, reading up on the 40K universe, again, because I'm a lapsed GW player, and I'd have paid off my student loans about 10 times faster if I had the money I spent on miniatures in high school and university back. But the books for the Death Watch were great for the fluff, which I guess is kind of a loaded term, great for all the background information, and just kind of strip out the rule stuff. But it reminded me what a horrifically bleak and dystopian and just messed the F up setting 40K is.
Yes.
And again, writing those distinctions for the different chapters, got to the Blood Angels, and it's great. You recruit from the irradiated hell worlds of Baal, where the people are so riddled with radiation that they're almost mutants. And then they go through the process of Hunger Games-style gladiatorial combat, and those winners get taken up to the Fortress Monastery and changed into Battle Brothers. And I'm like, really? All the resources available to you, and you guys are just like sitting up in your red sandstone tower going, no, we're not going to help you. It's like, really? That's like the same thing with the Space Worlds. Hey, the death world of Fenris that is locked in ice and Kraken, but breeding them makes them like super hard feral warriors. That's great. How about diverting some of that money from the war effort to your home worlds so things there don't suck?
Right.
And of course, like, they're not going to. And still on 40K, but that we've talked before about the young adult stuff that's set in 40K. And how are you going to do that? Because 40K is messed the F up.
You're right.
And do you really want to expose kids to that? And there have been discussions online about how early Games Workshop 40K stuff was kind of tongue-in-cheek, almost a little bit like Judge Dredd, and knew what it was doing, and haha, isn't this kind of ridiculous, the extreme to which we are going with our superheroes that have, like, 5 hearts, 3 kidneys, like, umpteen lungs, and all this kind of stuff. And based on other stuff I've seen, some of that kind of got lost a little bit, where you look at it and you're like, wow, these are the good guys and stuff, and you're like, do you not see, like, the horrific fascist undertones and all that stuff? It's like, nah, because pretty much anything that deviates from that norm by whatever, like, 0.000% of a winner gets cleansed.
Mm-hmm.
And that, when you really kind of look at it, you're like, holy, that is scary. And what a dystopian, horrific setting this is.
Right.
Those are supposed to be the good guys.
That's good.
I think I've kind of argued where, like, the Tyranids, they're going on just impulse.
Right.
So they might be the closest thing to good.
Right.
Or at least amoral in the 40K universe.
Because
even the Tau, which, old enough of a GW player, when I first started, they didn't exist. Mm-hmm. And when they introduced Tau, I'm like, what are these anime-looking things doing in my grimdark, baroque thing? I was like, oh, okay, whatever. But even they're kind of a bit sinister and kind
of
duplicitous.
They have like enslaving other races.
Yeah, it's like, it's for the greater good, but we're going to force you to do it anyway. Okay.
The origins of the original idea did sound like a storyline from like 2000 AD, and it's almost like people stopped getting the joke or stopped seeing the parody or satire in it and just started taking it seriously.
Yeah,
and that might explain, you know, why it attracts the kind of audience that it does, you know, that it has in certain times, is because once this stuff gets taken too seriously, then it starts to, reinforce some pretty ugly ideologies.
And it's just kind of ridiculous, again, reading the thing. It's just like, wow, for the past 10,000 years, you know, the Black Templars have created, and you're like, 10,000 years? Like, how do you keep anything working?
You know?
And just, or how do you remember something that long? And sure, space marines can live for centuries, but really, for the past millennia, you guys have just been, like, on this giant holy crusade. Okay, fine.
I love that. Yeah, everything's represented in millennia.
So, and it's a great setting as long as you kind of do what you said and realize that you're not taking stuff at face value. Mm.
Yeah.
It's funny because of the ridiculous extremes everything is.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's an important thing. And a lot of the, especially wargaming, has that. Because you're playing kind of parodies.
You're
of
not fascist. Playing a peace game.
Yeah, yeah, right. You're playing, kind of parodies of pre-existing fascist governments or different civilizations and things. And you have to kind of twist that a little bit. And, those differences give the flavor, but you're also incorporating some pretty ugly ideologies and things that made that exist historically. That ugliness and that, this is pre-apocalypse. We're right at the end of humanity, and this is how bad things get right before there's no more humanity. I like that aspect of the setting. It's just we're doomed. We're so doomed because even, the people that are religious fanatics are so twisted and so disgusting that you don't want them to survive.
So it was kind of like, what was the meme around 2006 about? It's like, I'm rooting for that asteroid. What do you want for it's that asteroid. Yeah. Personally, I'm rooting for the Tyranids. Just
you're just
they're my go-to party faction. Wife, yeah. Just consume it all. Yeah.
Only good world is a Tyranid world. Yeah. It's a Hive world.
An airless hunk of rock that's been scoured clean by rippers. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm so looking forward to playing this and seeing
how we'll have minis.
We will have miniatures. We'll have painted miniatures. Yeah, I can't wait.
Oh, painted. Wow. Yeah, painted. You're promising a lot.
I am. I've got a week. So thank you for going through all of this, and I hope that that's interesting to people. And if they have a setting and a system that they're trying to put together, kind of, the things that you thought through and what you were considering, I hope that helps, and I hope that gives people kind of a starting point.
I guess my main point of advice for doing that is either use a system you're very familiar with, because then that makes it easier to make the pieces do what you need to do to kind of emulate or replicate that setting, or find a system that already kind of does something a little similar.
Hmm. Something that's mechanics match.
Yeah. Giant pet peeve for people to use D&D to just do everything.
Right.
It's okay, great. D&D is a fantastic game. People love it. It is broad enough where it can do a lot of different things. It can't do everything.
Right.
And then people are like, how do I do a Vietnam-era war game about medics using D&D? I'm just like, don't.
You're right. That's the best advice. Look elsewhere. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you. Yeah, thanks for joining me. This is interesting. Keep a lookout on this channel, either Twitch or the YouTube, and you may be able to see us actually playing through this and rolling some dice and building doom pools and all that good stuff.
Yeah.
All right.
I guess if we do that too, I could put up a link to the because I made them public, the PDFs of the pre-generated characters.
Oh, good. Yeah. So yeah, that would be great. And then people can take a look at what we were using and going through. Yeah. So thanks for joining us. And please like and subscribe if you enjoyed this and otherwise. Yeah. We'll have Wayne back again and be talking some more.
Yeah, hopefully. Because I like to talk about stuff I like.
All right. Excellent. Okay. Thanks for joining us. Bye.
Drive through RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week, and we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. Drive-Thru RPG, the one true source for RPGs. We'll be right back.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.